Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Happy Monday. This should be a very, very cheery podcast because it's a Monday. It's May. The weather should be great. Flowers should be blooming, right? So I apologize for the fact that my newsletter starts off by telling people things are really going to get a lot more awful. And I don't just mean about the pandemic or the economy, our politics. You think we've bottomed out based on things that happened over the weekend? Donald Trump Jr. suggesting that Joe Biden is a pedophile, the president throwing out wild ass conspiracy theories about Obamagate. So we're going to get to all of that. So for this Monday in May podcast, we are joined by JVL himself and by Jim Swift, who is usually just the producer. But you know, Jim, you've been, I can just feel the vibes of you know, that you have things to say and to offer. So we wanted a full podcast, full staff podcast today. So Jim Swift, Jonathan Last, thanks for joining me. Appreciate it.
Hey, Charlie.
Hey. Okay, let's start from the bottom because there's so much stuff going on here. State Department Inspector General fired by President Trump Friday night. Apparently, now it turns out he was looking into allegations that a staffer in the State Department was working for Mike Pompeo was performing domestic errands and things like handling his dry cleaning, walking the family dog, making restaurant reservations, all of that sort of thing. And of course, this is not like a bottom feeding story, but Jim Swift, wasn't there a time when that would have been kind of a scandal, kind of swampy thing?
Yeah, I mean, when you work for, you know, a principal, there are things that you as a staffer would be willing to do to help facilitate their job. Walking their dog and making restaurant reservations, unless those aren't really typically related to their official duties. Booking them on a flight back to, you know, wherever they're from, sure, you know, if you're the scheduler. Yeah. But I remember back when Jim Traficant beamed me up, the congressman with the wig from Youngstown. He basically went to jail in part for pushing his staffers, among other things, to do personal projects.
Walking the family dog. I did, you know.
You know, I had a friend, Charlie, who for his first gig in Washington, he was told to do his boss's son's homework.
Oh, really? Okay, well, that's...
Yeah, he didn't work in government. He worked in the private sector, but the boss had a sixth grade kid who was something of a ne'er-do-well, and so my buddy was told to do the kids' homework every day.
I mean, I don't want to blow this off because there's obviously the slow motion Friday night, Saturday night massacre of the president who is eliminating these inspector generals. And as far as I can tell, Senate Republicans have just completely given up any pretense they're going to hold him accountable. You know,
how is this allowed?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a serious question. Okay. How does Congress allow this to happen? You want to say that Trump fires one inspector general on a Friday night? Okay, that's bad. But this is now clearly a concerted effort to remove all executive oversight. And the legislature is just going to roll over for that?
Yes. Yes.
Well, did you see Charlie's friend Ron Johnson issued a statement?
You're going to make me do this.
Oh, it seems to me these are just employees of the executive branch. No matter that they're funded by Congress, often created by laws, you know, and there are things Congress can do to protect them. But, I mean, he's right. There's an executive component on this, but it's not like, you know, the executive branch decided to come up and investigate itself just for the fun.
Hey, thanks for that shiv there. Just to break my ribs. You know, no, I was watching Ron Johnson on with Jake Tapper and he's defending. Saying, I'm not crying crocodile tears over the firing of the inspector general. And basically because the inspector general has to be loyal to the president or something like that. And I got to tell you what my gut reaction was that I've gone from being disappointed in Ron to really almost being shocked at how far he's gone down this. It's not just going back to JVL's point. No, why does Congress allow this? We're actually beyond that now. And Congress is, you know, key members of Congress are cheerleading this sort of thing. So you got Susan Collins, who furrowed her brow. That's become kind of a joke. Mitt Romney, we got to give him a little bit of a shout out. He did issue a strong statement, but he's alone. I mean, there's nothing else as far as I can tell. Right. So.
Do these idiots think that the Democrats are never going to have power again?
Yes. I mean, it's like Newt Gingrich swinging in on a trapeze with an Uzi, you know, permanent majority.
Because, you know, the precedent which is set here for the next corrupt Democratic president to do whatever they want is, and what are these people going to?
Well, I mean, this is the politics of projection. Actually, in my newsletter today, I had a string of tweets. I'm actually now trying to call it up while I'm talking to you guys, from Garry Kasparov, who I really admire, the Russian dissident, former chess champion, and really he understands part of the politics, this politics of projection. If you're a thief, you accuse your enemies of thievery. If corrupt, accuse your rivals of corruption. If you're a coward, accuse others of cowardice. Evidence is irrelevant. The goal is to dilute the truth and the case against you with everyone does it. So basically, in terms of corruption, they're going to create an environment where no matter what the corruption is, it's like, yeah, well, everybody's corrupt. Who cares? And so that we talk about norms and everything. But I mean, think what that does to this. So when the Democrats get into power, and if they are, in fact, corrupt, and Republicans are going to scream bloody murder and, Fox will be outraged. But we've created an environment where, yeah, everyone is a crook. Everyone is dishonest. Everyone lies. So therefore, it's all normal. So there we are. Hey, on a cheerier note, I got to figure out what a cheerier note would be here. Draw a line there because I'm not trying to say this is a cheerier note. But Justin Amash drops out of the presidential race. Not going to run as a Libertarian. Kind of a surprise because the assumption was that he would get the Libertarian nomination. And he basically says, nobody's interested in me as a third party and nobody thinks I can win. So JVL, why do you think he dropped out?
Because he's a serious guy who is thinking about the health of the country and not his own personal brand and not figuring out what the next step in his career is. I mean, I feel a little crazy saying this about anybody in electoral politics, but Amash seems to be who we thought he was, a guy who decided, hey, I could try a principal run here, saw the polling data, which showed that him running actually tightens things up for Biden and makes it more likely that Trump would be reelected. And so said, I'm not going to do that.
I think you obviously realize
it's weird to see a politician do that anymore.
Well, you're probably right on all of that. Of course, I'm always a little more cynical about this, but I do think he underestimated how binary this election feels. And I hesitate to do that because I argued against the binary choice 4 years ago and have tried to push back against that. But this one really feels like it's a binary choice. You either reelect Trump or you elect Trump. Either you give Trump 4 more years or you don't. And that is the binary choice. And so he just found that there was not much tolerance for a third party this year.
Yeah, and this is our colleague Sarah Longwell has done a bunch of focus grouping on this, and her findings were consistent with the actual hard poll numbers, which is that you take people who were third party voters last time around, so they were Gary Johnson types last time around, and a significant percentage of them have been moved to vote for Biden. They've gotten on Team Biden. And once you introduce Amash to it, the Biden voters suddenly go, oh, well, hold on. Maybe I'll vote for Amash. So, I mean, there's a real world aspect to this because you had the number of third party votes in 2016 were actually dispositive. If people hadn't voted for Evan McMullen and Gary Johnson, then Hillary Clinton would be president right now.
Yeah. Do you guys want the tinfoil hat explanation of the Amash candidacy?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We all need a tinfoil hat.
Okay. Well, I know it's not true because in Washington, you hear the rumors and the rumblings, and people I know had been approached, and Amash had been noodling this for months and months. And, like anything, there's NDAs and all these other sorts of things involved. But the tinfoil hat thing is Justin Amash never wanted to run for president as a Libertarian. This was just something that he could do to boost his profile and then go back and run for his old seat.
Well, we'll find out quickly because he'll have to refile, right? I mean, he would have to get back on the ballot. But I actually think that this is probably, Amash.
It was only an exploratory committee, so he could have been doing both.
Amash served a useful purpose that he was kind of a safe haven for a lot of non-Trumpy conservatives. And you saw certain people who, blue check marks, certain types who, immediately went there because this allowed them to be against Trump, but without, sullying their conservative credentials, which is a difficult situation. So, but I think that probably somebody also convinced him that his role in Michigan would not be necessarily constructive. So, hey, tell me about your thing with Brad Parscale. See how you print Brad Pascal, not to be confused with Blaise Pascal. JVL, you said that he's really become kind of the 2020 poster child for grifter con man, and there's a lot of competition there.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know. So the Death Star stuff got kicked off with McKay Coppins's excellent piece in the Atlantic about the $1 billion disinformation machine that Donald Trump's campaign has built. I have been slightly skeptical of that only because I am slightly skeptical about much of big tech. So, yeah, I mean, Jeff Bezos and the smart kids at YouTube have spent decades trying to get their prediction engines to be really, really good. And they have unbelievable amounts of data on your behavior, what you watch, what you buy, how and when you buy it. And even so, whenever you buy something from Amazon, they're always telling you, hey, would you like to buy these three things too?
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever bought any of the three things that they suggest. Mm. When you watch something on YouTube, they'll suggest the number of times that I take a YouTube suggestion is really, really small. And so I've been just skeptical about what sort of magic can Big Brad actually work with this. And the more I thought about it, the more I think that Brad is looking at this as his career, not a campaign. And he knows that Trump burns through campaign managers. He went through, what, three of them in the last runaround? And that was because Trump thought that all the campaign managers were doing was essentially setting his schedule. You know, they were just booking the planes for him, and he was the show, and he was the magic. And so what Brad wanted to do was to make himself absolutely unfireable. And the way to do that is to say that Donald Trump is not the election here. My thing is the campaign, you know, and wherever the president goes or doesn't go in his rallies, that's not what's going to win this for us. What's going to win this for us is the giant black box that I've built. And this has a number of advantages for him professionally, one of which is that it's not falsifiable until the election's over. You know, you can't say that it didn't work until Trump has already lost. Another of which is that Trump can't understand any of it. And a third of which is that it can't run without him because he is the secret sauce. He's the guy who is, you know, got everybody else siloed away from what it is he's doing. And so he's made himself unfireable. And I think that's it's brilliant in its own way. And it's a reminder, I think, as I said in my piece about him, you know, inside every con man is a mark. And Trump is a mark too, you know. So
is this vaporware, JBL?
I don't think it's vaporware. I think it's a real thing. He's built it. It's, you know, he's churning out, you know, ads by the hundreds of thousands that are all micro-targeted and that nobody can ever really see all of them. But I get people emailing me the Trump ads that are coming to their inbox, and they are so laughably unsophisticated. You know, in one of them, there was a survey where it was, you know, the question was, how much credit do you give President Trump for the amazing economy and our low unemployment figures? And another one that I was just sent by another reader today was, you know, President Trump has selected you as only 100 American patriots.
I've seen that one. That he wants.
And this is essentially like the Nigerian email scam. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be some percentage of people who fall for it, but it's a really low percentage, and it isn't super sophisticated. It's the type of thing that literally any campaign could run. It's just the equivalent of direct mail, you know?
Yeah, and okay, so let's talk about this, though. Talk about flooding the zone. I mean, Brad Pascal said he's got the Death Star, and they're going to flood basically whatever bullshit Trump puts out. They will flood the zone. And there's so much of it that it's almost impossible to keep up. And Tim Miller has another just outstanding piece in the Bulwark today where he talks about just what happened over the weekend, and the Trump's latest scandals are taking place in plain sight. And they're so obvious now that the media can't even get its head around the fact that they're actually seeing the scandal. Is that a fair way of saying it? So
yeah, I think that's right.
Here's some things that happened this weekend. Let me just read the seven of them. President of the United States, quote, tweeted an avowed alt-right account that flirts with Holocaust denial. This would be Michelle Malkin, right? Who's basically been deplatformed because of her just out and out white supremacy. Number two, the president texted supporters false allegations he had been illegally spied on by the previous vice president. Three, the president fired another independent inspector general without providing cause. Number four, the official death toll from COVID-19 inched close to 90,000 souls, actually getting close to 100,000 soon. Well, the president spent his time live tweeting cable TV. That's just normal. One of the president's large adult sons grotesquely suggested that Joe Biden is a pedophile. Another of his large adult sons claimed that the virus was a hoax perpetrated by the left and the media and that it will disappear after the election. And seven, the president sent a tweet encouraging protesters who aggressively shouted down and chased after a random local news reporter with calls, "You are the virus, traitor, and enemy of the people." And then he makes the point that this whole Obamagate thing is based on leaks from the director of national intelligence to advance an elaborate lie that accuses his opponent of committing illegal espionage against him. And as Tim writes, this is the most outrageous and pernicious lie that a president has levied against his opponent in my lifetime. And despite the president himself elevating this lie, it was not discussed on front pages across the country. Forget front pages. It's hard to find any article at all addressing the president's lesser insane charges. So I guess, you know, here we are at this moment where they are flooding the zone with this shit. Is it going to work?
I mean, I hate to be optimistic because that's off brand for me.
Please do, though.
But I just find it impossible to believe that a president whose base approval rate has always been underwater by 10 points, a guy who struggles to get to like 42-44% in a way that in presidential electoral politics, being under 50% is always danger zone, let alone being close to 40%, where you're going to have 120 to 150,000 dead Americans plus unemployment that is somewhere between 15 and 25%, running against an opponent who is personally very popular with wide name recognition and tied to a very popular former presidential administration, who has had the single largest and most durable lead ever held by any challenger ever against any incumbent president. I just don't see how that turns around. I mean, anything can happen, but it looks like you're talking about like a 1 in 10 or a 1 in 7 chance that Trump wins re-election. Because the base facts of this are going to be the unemployment numbers and the number of dead Americans. Like, all the rest of this stuff is just noise.
I agree with this. And I mean, one of the rules of politics is you don't get to change gravity. For normal voters out there, they're going to look at the unemployment rate. They're going to look at their 401k or their IRAs. They're going to look at the number of dead Americans. They're going to look at how things are going where they live and how things are affecting them and their family. If Trump and his team want to blast out conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory, I mean, we already have such a short attention span. People are just beginning to tune out these conspiracy theories. And the normal people will look at these regular things and the sort of whataboutism, chatty Cathy's, they'll pull the string and they'll go, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? You just don't have to respond to them. And I think if, you know, a lot of people in politics, I mean, we're talking about these kind of bigger, broad strokes, but, you know, we at the Bulwark wouldn't even have enough time to delve into every single conspiracy theory Trump tweets about in a 2-day period because there are like 12 of them. You know,
and yet we've been doing a pretty good job pushing back on them. And I think, okay, so here I think you guys are right. I think I agree with you. But since I'm sitting here in my basement and we haven't seen the sun in several days here, let me push back, give you the devil's advocate position that, in fact, you know, the campaign is going to play out where people are going to decide. I mean, here's the campaign. It's all China's fault. China attacked us. Those thugs from China, they need to be held accountable. This country was attacked. President Trump actually succeeded in stopping this thing, turning it around. Yes, only fill in the blank. And I think up to 200,000 people are going to, you know, they'll say this is still a win because he saved millions of lives. And we were also able then to stick it to the establishment, by which I mean the scientific experts, because I'm looking right now at a lot of folks on the right, and their morale is high. They're feeling, they're doing the fist bump, they're coming out, they're reopening the country, they're asserting their freedom. They have that populist mojo back again. The economy is going to come roaring back. We're going to be playing our games again. And this is a president who fought for us. He fought against that scientific establishment. He fought against the Chinese, you know, and it is fucking morning in America again.
I mean, that's certainly possible, but if it happens, it'll be the first time ever that a president isn't held responsible by the voters for very bad outcomes. Right. I mean, many, many presidents have had bad outcomes happen during their tenures, and you can always say, well, it's not really their fault. It's really, you know, the fault of external events, or it's a mix of the two. And voters always punish them in the same way that they reward them if things are good. And look, everything happens for the first time once, right? Maybe this is the first time that he's not held responsible. But that would also, I'd be more amenable to that being a probable outcome if there was a deep reserve of goodwill towards him in the country. But there isn't. People don't like him to begin with. And for anybody who is wavering on, anyone who basically needed an excuse to hop off the bus has it. And I don't know. Can I ask you something funny, though? So how is it that we have the president calling on Twitter, calling the coronavirus a plague, and then you have his son calling it a hoax? Like, this is what I don't understand about these people on this side, because, you know, like, which is it?
Yeah, is
Trump lying? Is Trump lying to, is the president Trump lying to the world, but like the grown ass Trump son is not lying? Like, is the president participating in the hoax by calling it a play? Like, what the hell is happening here?
Maybe we're over.
It's incoherent.
Well, it is incoherent, and maybe we're overestimating the power of linear logical thought. I mean, Well, how about the fact that they're saying this is all a Democratic plot to stop Donald Trump, and you look around and going, hey. The only way you can make that case, of course, is to ignore what's happening in the rest of the world. There is a planet. There are other countries that are doing these things. Are all of them plotting against Donald Trump? Is it all about Donald Trump? The incoherence of this, it's almost as if they're still trying to find out what the message is. Was it this massive, huge crisis that I solved, or was it a nothing burger from the beginning? My guess is they'll keep, like burglars trying to, you know, find out which door works. They'll keep focus grouping it to decide what they want to say. Here's another thing that's happening that, again, is no longer shocking, is no longer surprising, but still is a little bit shocking. Molly Jung Fast actually has a piece over at the Daily Beast talking about the latest line in conservative media. Laura Ingraham basically is, you know, saying it's time to stop coddling grandma. This is a direct quote. If you want to stay at home. But for the rest of us, we'll make our own decisions. Since the so-called experts say it will be around forever, it's time to move on with our lives. The testing issue is just another Democrat red herring, more impossible hoops. So we're now against the testing. There's a line, we're against the testing, we're against the tracing, and it's become cultural signaling not to wear a mask. Now, I know, JVL, you wrote about this. You want to talk about things that are incoherent, saying, let's open up the country right away, and let's decide that nobody needs to wear masks. And in fact, it's a don't tread on me moment that we refuse to wear masks.
Yeah, it's awfully hard sometimes not to be in favor of natural selection.
I know what you mean, but yeah,
you know, I mean, it's because it is all just signaling, and in a way, this is what we get for having reasonably successfully executed a mitigation and suppression effort over the last 2 months, right? By holding the death toll only to what's going to be the low six figures, which required a Herculean effort and enormous sacrifices on the part of just about everybody in the country, we have insulated idiots like this from the consequences of their actions. And that's kind of a shame.
It is kind of a shame. And I think that it's not new that we have kind of an anti-science, anti-expertise thread that runs through a lot of the right. But I think we're seeing it in full flower, and it's not going to end with the end of this this pandemic or with this presidency at all.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that this is now who they are, and this is, I mean, and when I think about this stuff in the long term, what worries me is that the Republican Party and conservatism is actually no longer interested in any specific policy outcomes. For them, the juice is simply breaking norms and signaling who they are and what they feel. And once you untether a political party and a movement from outcomes, and all they care about is grabbing power and posturing, they become dangerous. I mean, that's, you know, what they're pursuing is not an ideological agenda. It's just power. And this is how, like, bad things wind up happening. Yeah. You know, when people say, like, hey, we're lucky that we got Donald Trump and not Mussolini. like, right. Well, but the next time we may not be so lucky, right?
Jim?
I think there's a tie between being anti-science, as you're seeing from Laura Ingraham, and being conspiratorial, like you're seeing Candace Owens. And I don't think there's a lot of light of day in between the two of them. And it doesn't take much. And I think that's sort of going to Jonathan's point, that the state of the party that we've seen right now, when you become unmoored this way, you lose your grasp on reality. I mean, I'm just going to throw this out as a prediction and lay down a marker that we're going to see someone prominent suggest that, like, test and trace is just like a government plot to get our DNA, right? Like,
oh yeah. Come on. Sure.
Like that's like someone people found reasonable pre-Trump is going to say that, you know, because we thought at the very beginning of all of this that Candace Owens was like the insane one. And now, like, Laura Ingraham is just one standard deviation away. You know, it's just everyone is sliding down a hill. And I'll agree with JVL. I mean, this is where dangerous things happen. But I mean, once these barriers are destroyed, I mean, like, you know, like erosion, once you've eroded something, it takes a lot of time to build it back up. And
I got two words for you guys. Space Force.
Ooh.
Space Force. You guys watch the recruitment video for Space Force? I mean,
no. You mean this is the Netflix special?
Yeah, no, this is, that's like a 30-second recruitment. No, it's, so the President of the United States is focusing on Space Force. Hey, speaking of which, I have to admit, I really love that little bit of Trumpian porn where they superimpose Trump's face over the president. Was it Pullman, the actor? Bill Pullman's scene from Independence Day. You guys have seen that. Over the weekend, the president tweeted it out, and obviously in order to trigger the libs. But what I find fascinating about that genre is that in Trump world, you have to create this sort of fantasy world. You have to create this kind of, you know, pornified version of reality where Donald Trump is much skinnier, where he has, you know, a six pack, where he is eloquent, where he is a leader, where he rides eagles in to say, or rides dragons into, you know, save America. So that in their heads, they've created this sort of this fictitious universe where Donald Trump is who they want him to be, right? Isn't that the genre of those things? And then you see the video, and there's Sean Hannity's head, and there's Ted Cruz's head, and there's one of the large adult son heads and everything. It's difficult to do that. No, it's not difficult to do that. I mean, it's essential to actually do that. I think for their cognitive ability to say, this is the greatest ever, this president, because you and I, we're looking at Donald Trump going, what the hell? How do you not see this guy, you know, this overgrown man-child narcissist, and yet they've created where, no, he is the God King.
This is anime for Republican dude bros. You know, we already know that they have LARPers who go to state capitals and like to play dress up, but it's the same concept as like the people who dress up as furries and spend all their time watching obscure Japanese television.
See, I don't even know anything
like
about
that.
I was just going to
people with their own special second reality, Charlie.
Okay.
But it's for Republican dude bros with helmet hair like me.
Okay. Okay. Can we switch topics now? Okay. So among the interesting things that happened over the weekend, and this is the part of the problem of doing the Monday podcast, because there's so much that's happened since Friday. It felt to me that in the last 3 days, the Tara Reid story has completely fallen apart. You have had a series of really devastating deep dives. The Vox story came first, then PBS, then this Politico story. Vox raised some really serious questions about why her story had changed so much. The PBS story went and reached out to hundreds of former Biden staffers, talked to, I think, 74, 75 of them, none of whom seemed to corroborate Tara Reid. One of whom says that, yeah, he remembers her. He worked next to her in the mailroom and she was fired because she was so incompetent. Then you have the story from Politico that goes back and raises questions about, you know, her manipulative lies and the way that she was kind of a scam artist. And again, none of them are definitive in refuting her allegation against Joe Biden. But cumulatively, this is just a devastating takedown of her credibility. So, JVL, you've been following all this.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, we're always fighting the last war. And so everybody immediately thought that she would be Christine Blasey Ford, because we could only view this in the context of the Kavanaugh hearings. But people forget that there were four women who accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct, and only one of them was even superficially credible. The other three were clearly not credible for a variety of reasons. And so why is it that everybody assumed that Tara Reid must be Christine Blasey Ford and that she couldn't have been Julie Swetnick? And I think that that's where we finally are now, is that there is no reasonable person working in good faith could look at the cumulative weight of what has been put forward now and say that she is more like Christine Blasey Ford and less like Julie Swetnick. She seems to be a wholly unreliable witness whose story itself has changed numerous times, whose story has a number of holes in it. And the aspects of the story which are disprovable and are falsifiable have been falsified and disproven. Specific claims like the fact that the assault took place in an alcove when there are no alcoves there, the claim about why she was fired, the claim about having been asked to work at a campaign fundraiser when people from Biden's office say that there was a bright line that no office staffers from his Hill office were ever working campaign fundraisers because he didn't want to commingle campaign work with Senate work. It just doesn't seem to me that there is any possible way to view her as reliable. And all that said, I fully expect her to be a guest of Donald Trump at his first debate against Joe Biden. Well, she'll be sitting there next to Melania.
This was the most recent development, that her lawyer is now saying that the Trump communications folks reached out to her, which struck me as, well, of course. I mean, that's completely, was inevitable, even though her story has completely fallen apart. I guess I had a couple of reactions to this. Number one, her story is so shaky, and the Politico report seems to suggest that if you go back and you ask people who've known and worked with her for years, they pretty much say, yeah, she was very flaky, very much a scam artist, very manipulative, not the kind of person that you would trust at all, which raises the question, why did this story get as far as it did? And I hope that people on both sides of the aisle kind of just step back and go, look, there's something wrong with this idea that we need to, quote unquote, believe all women, because that means that we do not do our due diligence before we smear men who might be completely innocent, or women who might be completely innocent. But I mean, this story is so shaky, and it feels like you push at it and it falls over. During the Kavanaugh hearings, a lot of those things, took place within, a few days. It took a few days to figure out whether they were credible or not credible. This, they've had months. And I do wonder, how the media did not catch up more quickly to this. You know, you follow what I'm saying?
See, I actually have a great deal of sympathy for the media here, because one of the conserved critiques have been, you guys won't even report on the story. Right. And the answer is, because most conservatives don't do any reporting whatsoever, wouldn't know how to report a story if you asked them to. As we discovered from Vox and from some other places, there were people on this beat and had been on this beat for months and months and months. And the reason that they didn't report anything was because they couldn't do it because the story was so shaky. This is, the people who were that Vox piece is really the most, in a weird way, the Vox piece is even more devastating than the PBS piece.
She wanted to believe her so badly.
Because she wanted to believe, and she spent hours upon hours upon hours over the course of many, many months. And she kept seeing this woman's story change over and over again. She had, the woman was, Tara Reid was asking her friend to lie to the reporter for her. The excuse that she gave for why she was changing her story did not hold any water whatsoever. She said that she felt like the media outlets she had been talking to were trying to shut her down, when that was not true. She changed her story even while talking with a woman from Vox, about how she wanted it portrayed. And so anyway, again, the point is, it isn't as if the real media, by which I mean people actually report for a living, weren't doing any of this. They were. They just knew far before any of the rest of us did how incredible a witness Tara Reid was.
And there was probably a reluctance to be the first one to come forward and say, by the way, this is completely untrue. Anyway, we need to sort of re-engineer or reverse engineer the whole Kavanaugh story as well, because as you point out, there were stories that were quickly debunked, but they were widely reported, at least initially. And the role of Michael Avenatti there, I would think that folks in the media do, and in politics in general, who spread these things, do need to do a little bit of introspection about this. We don't have time to get into it, but there's a really surprising and tremendous piece by piece in the New York Times. Is it by Ben Smith? Is that the
founder of BuzzFeed?
Yeah, I mean, and very surprising, sort of a, I won't say it's a takedown of Ronan Farrow, but it is the most critical view of Ronan Farrow, who, of course, is the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who broke many of the most important Me Too stories and has become kind of a legend. And so to read in the New York Times a piece that kind of questions whether he gets things right all the time, whether he cuts corners, whether he makes charges that he cannot support, the number of stories he's reported that just turn out not to be true. And it's sort of a reminder, though, that what happens when a reporter becomes a celebrity, when they become so successful that they become bulletproof, but also the extent to which, if you want to believe something true and someone reports it, there's less scrutiny. So, think about all the people who took Michael Wolff's book seriously until it turned out to be BS, or who really wanted to believe Omarosa until that turned out not to be true. And I think there's a little bit of that Ronan Farrow. The Ronan Farrow had the wind at his back. Everybody wanted to believe him. It was a shocking story and did not want to ask too many questions about whether or not all of his reporting was sound. This is a problem. And it is kind of a man bites dog to see the New York Times take this position on Ronan Farrow. Was one of the ones that was definitely not on my my dance card.
So this isn't a comment just about Ronan Farrow, but it's more of a, it can apply to him, but it's a broad based thing. And I think just from what I've personally witnessed in journalism and punditry is, once someone becomes a sensation, they kind of need the dopamine hits that keep on coming. And sometimes you can't always recreate the magic. Sometimes you're a one hit wonder. And sometimes some people get into situations where they want to keep recreating that magic, and they might be willing to make compromises to do it.
Well, and they might not have, grown up in an era where you learned certain journalistic rules, and where you had senior reporters or editors who slapped you around when you didn't source your quotes, or you didn't support your lead, or you made assumptions that were not checked, that you didn't dot all the I's and cross all the T's. I mean, it used to be that you'd start off at a regional newspaper and you would learn that and you get beat up and you'd learn how to get things right or get things wrong less frequently, because we all get things wrong. Move up to a, you know, regional newspaper, then move up to a big newspaper. Well, now those newspapers are all gone, and a lot of the people who are reporting now have no background whatsoever. And I think we can think of a number of names there. So, okay. So,
yeah, yeah. But this is also, yeah. Charlie, this is also a thing that happens. I mean, you see throughout the history of journalism, guys like Buzz Bissinger or Seymour Hersh, who early in their careers have some blockbuster stuff. And then it turns out that either they change, or those blockbusters were perfect storms or lucky hits for them. And over the course of years, they reveal who they really are. And so, I mean, this, it's not an entirely new phenomenon. This is a thing that sometimes happens in journalism.
No, I think that's absolutely true. All right. So let's talk about, before we're running out of time here, let's talk about where we're at on the coronavirus. I know, JVL, you've been writing an awful lot about looking at the trend lines, looking at the prospects. Not being an expert, I'm looking at this, and there's this weird cognitive dissonance that we are still, we're going to hit 100,000 dead Americans by June 1st. I mean, that seems inevitable. You do see spikes in some of the areas that have reopened, but the overall trend is down. And we're seeing the pictures and the stories of the reopening and the partying and the people flocking, and that we're all done with this. And so it's as if the country has decided it's over and we don't need to care anymore, while the death count is still horrifically high. So give me your take of where we are at now.
Yeah, so I think we've been on at least 2 weeks of pretty recognizable improvement. Not everywhere. There are a handful of areas where things are getting worse, not better. But on the whole, we're doing okay. Testing after plateauing, sort of number of tests being done daily, seems to be inching up a little bit more, which is good. Everything that I have seen on this suggests that you need the capacity to do about 1 million tests a day. And again, this... when the people on the right who are, you know, pro open everything up demand that, like, you know, they keep setting these impossible goals of 35 gajillion tests a day. That just isn't the truth. You know, we've been doing about 250 to 350,000 a day. We would like to be doing about double that, triple that if possible. Here's the thing. What you want is not lockdowns for forever. What you want is to pluck all of the low-hanging fruit that allows you to reduce the number of contacts that a person has on a daily basis. This is how you manage these things. And it doesn't mean like indefinite. Who cares about barbershops? If you want to let barbershops and nail salons reopen, that's great. That's fine. What you have to worry about is the big ticket items where people have lots and lots and lots of contacts, right? And so how do you manage department stores? How do you manage sporting events, concert venues, airports, trains, mass transit, schools? And those are the things that people haven't really thought all the way through. And the second thing you need to do is think through, where are the contacts really semi-essential and where are they really luxury goods? I am happy to see pictures of people at the beach, so long as they're not piled on top of one another. It's good to get out. There is no reason that you do need to be on top of one another at the beach. That's perfectly fine. When I see like a bar in Milwaukee packed full of 28-year-olds, my head wants to explode. Because why do you need to do that? that is a very bad, and again, those are the things which seem to me to be foolish uses of contacts, right? If you view your budget as saying, like, I have X number of contacts a day that I can have, why would you spend all of them on being in a bar for 3 hours?
Yeah, that just seems, that seems almost performative, although... I can certainly understand why people are just sick and tired of being at home. But you made a point a couple of weeks ago, though, about that you just can't reopen the country. I have a hard time imagining that you're going to see people going back to the movie theaters. There was that poll in Wisconsin that people, you know, obviously a lot of people are willing to go back to the restaurants and the bars, but a very small percentage were willing to go back to concerts, large scale sporting events or anything like that. I cannot imagine people getting on airplanes in big numbers anytime soon. So, and frankly, why would you go back to a department store when you can do most of your shopping online? So I think this is going to be an extremely complicated situation.
Yeah. And schools are the big ones. I mean, the thing which nobody has really thought through all the way is what are you going to do with schools? And that's hard. I don't have the answers to that. But if I were going to look at it and say, what is the next big cultural flashpoint we're going to have over this? It's going to be the question of school openings.
What is the answer, though? I mean, so we hear that young people are not that vulnerable, right? That's not the vulnerable population. So why not reopen schools?
Well, because, I mean, first of all, there are young people who are vulnerable. The number of people who are immunocompromised in one degree or another is much larger than people tend to mm-hmm. understand. But what you worry about is you worry that the kids bring home to the family whatever bugs they pick up when they're at school, right? This is anybody who's ever had a child, you know, in first grade or kindergarten knows exactly what this is like. And so the kid brings home whatever bugs they come into contact with. And one of the things we have seen is that what the epidemiologists are calling, it's actually wonderful, the young old. So like people who are 50 to 60, they are more vulnerable to this than we originally right. thought. You know, the old are the most vulnerable. You know, if you're over 70 or over 65, you are in real danger of COVID-19. But people from 50 to 65 or so, it's not a super duper safe thing. So anyway, you were, but on the other hand, like people have to go to work, right? You know, can we all keep spinning the plates while homeschooling our kids? And, you know, what are colleges going to do? Colleges need to, which, anyway, all of which is to say that I don't have the answers to this, but this is, I think, a very, very large problem. And we're going to have to get our arms around
it. You're right. And see, this is the part that I hope I can articulate this. This whole notion that, you know, let's go out and be warriors and show how brave we are by going out to restaurants or bars or going into the public because, you know, this is what we have been asked to do. But for most young people, they're not going out and being brave because they're not risking their own health. What they are risking is contracting the virus and then passing it on to somebody else who is vulnerable, which is not a form of yeah. courage at all. And so that is the problem. When you think about a school, all of the people who are not children who are encountered, who are going to be involved, because as any parent knows, the school is a petri dish for spreading all kinds of things, right? You send your kid and they come back with everything. Somebody gets the flu, somebody gets a cold, they come back with it. But there are the bus drivers, there are the maintenance people, there are the teachers, there is the support staff, then there are the parents who are at home. How many, if you sort of extend it out from that child to, you know, three or four contacts, what is the likelihood that they are going to encounter somebody who is in this immunocompromised or vulnerable status? And I would think it gets close to 100%, right? I mean, at some point that you're going to come back, you're going to contact your parents. Your parents have parents. Your parents have coworkers. Your parents have people that you associate with. So the vectors become very dramatic. On the other hand, the political pressures are going to be overwhelming. And I guess that's where we're at the moment, where the political pressures seem to be overwhelming, that once you've reopened things, the pressure to not close things again is going to be incredibly intense, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's also, I'm sorry, Jim, one second. There's also the other thing here, which is that there's going to be some percentage of families who simply won't be willing to send their kids back for various reasons, right? They've got a grandparent who's in chemotherapy, and so they don't, you know. And so that percentage is going to, I don't know what percentage it'll be, but I suspect it'll be higher than like 5%, which means that whatever they decide to do, schools are going to have a two-track system where they allow some kids to do all the work from home and allow some kids to come into school? I mean, they're going to have to, it's a very complicated problem, and there probably is not going to be a one-size-all solution for it. And the hope, I think, is that if we can get some sort of therapeutic regimen in place, which lowers the overall case fatality rate for older people, then you can start, right? This is the big, you know, there's a run on Pepcid over the weekend because there is a single paper which suggests that the OTC ingredient in Pepcid, the winds up helping reduce case fatality rate for people who have been hospitalized. And so people are stupid. They saw this story on like CNBC or something, and they thought, oh, well, I'm going to stop myself from getting the COVID by going and buying all the Pepcid at CVS, which is crazy. Again, it's not preventive, it's therapeutic. And we don't know that it's real either. We haven't actually done any real clinical trials on it. But if we can develop some therapeutic protocols, which in theory should be easier to do than coming up with the vaccine, like that's another way to start inching closer towards reopening. Again, there's this false choice of like, you know, oh, we have to keep everything closed until there's a vaccine and you have to be wearing a mask even when you're by yourself in the car. No responsible person is saying any of that stuff. We just have to be like smart about it.
Right. Those are convenient straw men. So, Jim, did you want to weigh in?
This kind of goes to the point JBL made in a column for the Bulwark a couple weeks ago about the choice on reopening is left to other people and other families. Brave 28-year-olds insisting that the bars, you know, serve them alcohol. They don't get to choose, you know, what movies come out if they come out. There was a good article in the Post over the weekend about the new Tenet film that is sort of like the test film of the summer. And you know, one movie exec said, well, if that flops, they're not going to be any movies in theaters until Christmas, assuming there are theaters that exist at Christmas. There was a person on our Virginia task force that the governor put together about reopening, and she owns like a wellness salon that does massages and things. And the governor said, oh, we're going to probably start reopening around this time in phase one. And she goes, no, I'm not going to do that. Same with the schools. People are going to make this decision. So it isn't this binary choice of closed versus open. There are going to be lots of people who, even in a reopen scenario, even in the light reopen in the different phases, they're not going to do it. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people out there, and you see these performative mask videos where people are filming, you know, frontline grocery store workers saying, you're abridging my civil rights by not letting me in without a mask and stuff like that. I'm afraid that's just all going to get worse, and they're going to pressure good people who are making the decision they think is best for them and their families and their businesses, and it's going to become even more performative and potentially even more violent.
I think that's true. Do you see the video of the woman who was trying to harass some grocery store that had a you know, no masks, no service rule? Have you seen this?
Yes.
Where she comes up with a video and she's harassing the store employees, and the store employees are very, very professional, very nice. And they tell her, ma'am, you can't shop here if you don't have a mask, but you know what? I will run in, I will get you a mask. And she's like, no, I have a health condition. She's videotaping. I have a health condition that prevents me from wearing a mask. And because of HIPAA regulations, you cannot ask me to disclose the nature of that. And at that point, you know, that she's not dealing in good faith, right? I mean, you know, she's invoking HIPAA to not do it. And she's, I want to see the manager. And the manager comes out and says, ma'am, we will get you the mask. In fact, you know what we'll do? We want to help you. We will do your shopping for you. Just give us a list. We will do the shopping for you and take care of it. And she says, well, I have private things that I want to buy that I don't want you to know the private things. And plus, you want me to give you my bank information, my bank card? Why would I do that? Which, of course, raises the
question. Grocery stores don't know the private stuff she buys already.
see, this was the problem. It's like, you know, if you buy it, we'll have a record of it. And you, if you were going to pay with a credit card, we were going to use that anyway. But she was doing this as a way of, like, you know, essentially harassing the store, a private business, for having the standard. And I think this is one of the ugliest things, you know, the only way that this all works is if we're kind of all in this together and there's kind of, you know, social pressure to behave in a responsible way. And Jim's right. I think you're going to have that countervailing pressure. So I don't know what.
But the video had a great ending with the guy dancing.
Did I get to that?
You got to go back and watch it. At the very end, when the woman is just kind of given up, the very first guy who's cleaning the carts just does a little happy dance. And it was not like a jig or something. You could tell he's just, that's something he does. And it's just, it's the perfect capstone. You have to go watch the video.
It is perfect. All right. There's so many other things to touch on, but we are out of time. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me on a, at least here in Wisconsin, a very dark and wet Monday in May.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.